this twin anniversary of the birthday of your great leader, Dr. Wiseman, and the anniversary of the decision of the United Nations some 3 years ago. I believe all the friendly people of the world were deeply touched by the drama of the return of the children of Israel to their promised land, and a return which was made with great courage and determination and a powerful purpose and will to succeed. It carried with it pioneers who entered into the problem of development and settlement of very desolate lands in a most remarkable manner. I find that automatically I always turn in my own mind to events in the history of this country in order to measure an appreciation of somewhat similar events that are occurring. And in thinking of the 3 short years of the existence of the sovereign state of Israel, I look back to refresh my mind as to the first 3 years of our country under its present constitution, which began in 1789. They were years beset with difficult, baffling problems of literally every kind. And at the end of the 3 year period, this being the end of the 3 year period of the life of the sovereign state of Israel, in this country, in 1792, there were frontier difficulties of tremendous importance. Along the Great Lakes, there were military posts that had not yet been evacuated by our recent opponent in the Revolutionary War. The Treaty of Peace was still 2 years distant. That's 3 years after we started in business, as it were. In the South, Spain was contesting for frontiers, Cindy of Florida, and was also contesting with us the right to the navigation of the Mississippi River. This at the end of the first 3 years of our struggle into our present position in the world. And there were areas greatly disturbed by Indian uprising. And there were every conceivable problem of currency, taxes, tariffs, pensions, a world of other difficulties. So against that background, when I try to measure in my mind what has occurred in the state of Israel, I think truly remarkable progress has been made. You have had great problems of political, economical, and sociological nature, and many others that remain to be overcome before you approach the ideal of those who have built up this great prospect. Dr. Wiseman, in whose honor this dinner is occurring tonight, I first came to know in Washington in the very depressing, dangerous year of 1942. And as I recall, I was introduced to him by a gentleman who just introduced me tonight, the then Secretary of the Treasury. Dr. Wiseman had come to this country to add his voice to the urgent requests of the British Parliament and British leaders for assistance in materiel to meet the threat to the Middle East, Cairo in particular, of rum in Africa. We had very little to offer then. We were in dire necessity of material for our army that we were attempting to build up. However, we managed to scrape together some important material and dispatch it with all possible speed in the Middle East. The fact that a great victory was won was an ample, bountiful reward for whatever we were able to do at the time. I might interject here this comment. Well, this additional comment that I've made a number of times recently, this seems to be in the present situation just where I came in before. And when I'm talking about materiel, the same pressures, the same necessities, urgent, now exist again. And I am on the recipient end of the request. Very little change in many respects. However, I think many have forgotten the very honorable and courageous part that was taken by units, the Jews in Palestine, in the fighting that occurred at that time. And how much was done from Palestine by the Jews of that region to assist and contribute to the general effort to suppress the Nazis. And further than that, the numerous acts of really greatest gallantry of the members of the race who parachuted in the rear of the Nazi lines to carry out the most dangerous possible missions. All of that is a part of history to have to be forgotten in the present struggles. But it all goes into the makeup and towards the future development of a nation which will build up in strength, I feel certain, to resist communist aggressions, to maintain its peace in that region, and to make a very genuine contribution in the world towards peace and security generally. I hope in conquering the remaining preliminary difficulties of national life that the State of Israel will early arrive at that degree of independence where it can sustain itself out of itself and where its prosperity will enable it to raise the standard of living of its people to the point that they would desire. And along with that prosperity will come benevolence, an attitude which will enable them to forget the scars of the strife and tribulations leading up to the organization of the state, and would lead to the contribution of their great developments to the other regions nearby who are in so much need of the same general developments. In the main, to produce productive lands where now it is arid and desert. That brings me to the main purpose, I understand, of this dinner tonight, this gallery, which is towards your three higher schools, and in one of which I have particular interest, the Weizmann Institute of Science, where I understand very special efforts are being made to develop the technique or understanding or the ability to convert arid districts into bountiful land. I know you are all intensely, I might say desperately, interested in the events in Korea. I am restrained from making very general comments because of the fact that the issues are now under immediate consideration here in your neighborhood at Lake Success. It would be most inappropriate for me to be commenting at any length as to the details of the various points of view. The situation is critical. We must do everything we can to get it in hand. I'm sure everything will be done, but we look with the most intense interest to the consideration and decision, action, stand of the United Nations. Force in Korea consists of representatives of a great many countries. Our own United States troops, naturally, are the larger part, along with these recently organized Korean units. And they've all suffered throughout the campaign very heavily in casualties, both battle casualties and other casualties incident to the particular characteristics of that campaign, both as to its movements and as to terrain. All of this, and the tension that has been created in the world by the incidents that have developed there, by the actual fact of the invasion of South Korea, has produced a very critical issue for us here and for all the world. Our Congress has just come into session. It will be necessary for them to consider immediately certain measures to enable us in this country to carry out the measures that seemed urgently required at this particular time. We are very much in need of an intelligent understanding on the part of the public as to just what the situation is, as to ourselves and as to our abilities, our capabilities, I should say, at this time, and what is needed from the Congress of the United States and the administration. I'm going to take a moment of your time to try to make several points that I regard of great importance clear to you, if I can. In the first place, we're in a situation which is different, I believe, from any in which we have ever been situated heretofore. And it imposes something for which we were not prepared. I'm talking about what we call a partial mobilization. Now, to the average person, it would seem a very simple proposition that if you've been on the basis of either peace on the one side or total mobilization for war on the other, a simple proposition to scale down the ladder to a temporary mobilization point. It is not at all so. It is an intensely complicated and difficult proceeding and requires the action in a great many particulars of the Congress of the United States. Our laws and the regulations growing out of those laws pertaining to what is the largest part of any defensive force that we have, our civilian components, are based on a peacetime setting or a full war mobilization. Never anticipated those laws. We would have a long period of tension in which we tear men away from their homes, their families, their business, and go along, we do not know how long. It's quite evident that at the very best, we're faced by a long period of tension. All the agreements in the world that we seek to get, that we're trying to most earnestly to get, we could not accept them all in the moment and then abandon our defensive posture. We have to wait till good faith is demonstrated. So I say at the very best, we have to face a long period of tension. That is something the American public has never been called upon to do. We had a tension in 1939 and 40 and 41. But it was a tension during which there was a world war and all of Europe was swamped, as you know so tragically, pertaining to the Jewish race in particular. And yet in the midst of that tension, in the midst of the measures we took, which actually were a full mobilization, both as to men and as to materiel, we only saved those forces by a single vote in August of 1941. Now we're facing a tension which we hope and pray will not involve any great destructive war such as was going on at that time. Now how does our public respond to that? That is, now we're involved in procedure of a partial mobilization, a setting which must lend itself automatically and almost instantly to full mobilization if that become necessary, but which at the moment I would think would be ill-advised. Now how do we go about it? How do we set up such a procedure that the American public will continue to accept and to support? I have used the word enduring. We've got to have something that is enduring, that the public will continue to support, even though they're not the great excitements, the great tragedies that bring about an emotional rise for the moment. We mustn't create mountains and then slough off into valleys again. Everybody is unanimous. I think there's complete unanimity in the feeling that we must immediately build up our strength, that we must immediately build up our strength. We need to be very careful not to set up a mountain which we will inevitably just slough off into a valley of weakness. We must find an enduring method that pertains to the materiel proposition. Putting it briefly, we must have a setting that is rapidly expandable. That means assembly lines of a nature and the tools and the dies, the jigs and everything of that sort that will enable us quickly to increase production as it is needed and not just set about building up great piles of things, you might say, in the numbers and then having them go obsolescent or the productive facilities becoming idle because everything has been passed out. Now the same applies to men. Great standing forces in this country, we've never had them, except in the state of full mobilization in 1941. And then we almost lost them, right in the middle of a great crisis. We almost lost them then. We have to have some system that will endure as to the support of the American public. We must know what is required in such a system. And it must be of such a nature that it provides the reserves that you need almost instantly prepared to act. And yet is of such a nature that it doesn't beggar us financially. I can illustrate that a little bit by what happened in Korea. And I can talk rather frankly about that because I was not a part of it. I didn't come into the government until the effort of the Northern Koreans had collapsed because of the landing near Seoul. In fact, I came in, I think, about 10 days, 2 weeks, 3 weeks after that. So I was not a party to this. What actually happened was a dilemma that approached the catastrophic because we did not have available trained reserves. I'm not talking about numerous divisions. I'm talking about men, individuals. We only had four divisions in Japan, and of course those were the first moved into Korea. And it was quite a time after that before any other troops came to their assistance, other than the South Koreans themselves. Those four divisions were at about half strength. But if they had been at full strength, it would have been about 72,000 men. Now it is a fact that General MacArthur had to put into their ranks, of those American units, 30,000 South Koreans. We took 17 weeks during the war to train replacements, individuals, and that was about a 12-hour day. In fact, I received many complaints from individuals, from parents, and from leaders in the political life. that this was too strenuous. Yet that was 17 weeks, and it was thought to be too little. They had to put 30,000 Koreans into a 72,000 organization with 3 weeks training. They had to create South Korean divisions in 4 weeks. Some of our divisions were 2 years being gotten in shape to send to Europe. Our Selective Service Act, which is in effect a compulsory service act, produces the authority, but is afflicted with the number of deferments under the law, under the regulations, which limit very decidedly the number of men that can be called. Certain changes in that, I think, will have to be made, and I don't anticipate much difficulty in their being made. But I was rather interested to have brought to my attention, in relation to this gathering tonight, that apparently, historically, Moses was the architect of compulsory service. However, this amused me a little bit, as I'll explain later why. He had deferments that would not be at all acceptable today. In the first place, he deferred, he let out all those weak in spirit, quite evidently feeling that there were not too many of them and they wouldn't be worth much anyway. He deferred the builder of the house if he had not yet dedicated. He deferred even the young man who was betrothed to the young lady but had not yet taken her over. And I was thinking then, when this was brought to my attention, of the immediate problem of the new Assistant Secretary of Defense, your protege, Herr Rosenberg. When I left her today, she was in the middle of the struggle of deferments, and she would have disagreed completely with Moses. We were suffering from an affliction of deferments. I might say, in regard to her, that she's already done a very fine work and is on the way to do a very splendid work. I had known her, and been aware of her ability, personality, her courage, her necessary toughness, and the fact that quite evidently she was the leading individual in this country in relation to manpower. There's some surprise when her name was put forward. There's less surprise now around the penny. I've been sorry to learn that there have been various rumors and allegations as to the influences and all that put Anna Rosenberg in office. Now, the truth is, I selected her because she quite evidently to me was the leading individual I knew of to do what I found was a very pressing and very difficult job. Because I found on my back five, at least, different sections of the Pentagon coming at me in relation to manpower. Manpower for the military forces. Manpower through the munitions board as to industry. Manpower in relation to the various personnels that we had in outside of the fighting forces. Manpower in relation to the scientists, to the engineers, to the doctors. All of these various things. And in relation to the National Guard, in relation to the Reserve Corps. It was a phantasmagoria of various influences in connection with manpower. She seemed to be the person. I didn't consult anybody. So she came into office in the Defense Department in a very critical operation and at a very critical time to her own ability, pure ambition.